From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So now we have a better idea of which Democrats will be running the show when Congress changes hands in January, but we still don't have any clarity about what it's going to mean for U.S. involvement in Iraq. It certainly seems like stay the course has run its course. So what can we expect instead? If there's one Democrat in a position to say, it's Carl Levin, chairman in waiting of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
We should pressure the White House to commence the phased redeployment of U.S. troops from Iraq in 4 to 6 months.
Levin's proposal for phased redeployment isn't a new one. Congressman Jack Murtha famously called for the same thing a year ago. But these days, the plan seems to have gotten a lot more supporters. Here's Senator Barack Obama on Good Morning America.
What I would do is sit down with the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the military that's actually on the ground and figure out how do we fit together a military strategy that can start that phased redeployment.
Soon-to-be Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid is on board as well.
We need to have a redeployment in Iraq. What does that mean? Pull everybody out now? Of course not.
So then, what does it mean? Specifics are scanty, but in general, proponents talk about pulling U.S. troops out of Iraq, bringing some of them all the way home, and leaving others on the periphery of the war zone. Opponents, however, call redeployment nothing but a euphemism. Do you make redeployment of money from an ATM machine, wrote one visitor to the blog Campus Progress? Do you use the redeployment method of birth control? Council on Foreign Relations President Emeritus Leslie Gelb is among those who favor redeployment, if it's combined with a political effort to make Iraq into a sort of republic with three semi-autonomous zones. But even Gelb admits that there's a certain amount of rhetorical gamesmanship going on with the Democrats.
The word withdrawal has been made into a synonym for cut and run. So they have to find another word to describe what they're trying to do. This is blue smoke survival language.
By which you mean blue smoke and mirrors to obscure the real picture.
Sure. But the situation in this case is not entirely blue smoke. They're proposing a combination of withdrawals and redeployments. They're essentially saying, take troops now in the fight in Iraq and move them to a safer place there, say up to Kurdistan, or move them to nearby Kuwait. They really want to take out most of the U.S. troops out of the country, out of the area. But they can't say it now because the Republicans say that means cutting and running.
So what do you think would be the most honest way for these Democrats to communicate what it is they're proposing?
I'd use both words.
Cut and run?
I'd say that they want to withdraw the bulk of the troops from Iraq and from the area, and redeploy some number of troops in order to continue training Iraqi forces, dealing with emergencies inside the country, and deterring any intervention by neighbors.
So it seems that one of the first people who started to call for something called phased redeployment from Iraq was Larry Korb. He's from the liberal think tank Center for American Progress. He's also a veteran of the Reagan-era Defense Department, which also used the term redeployment when discussing how to get American troops out of Lebanon back in the 80s. Any historical parallel there?
Sure. Blue smoke has a long history. What we were doing was taking our troops out of Lebanon because a whole bunch of them had been killed and President Reagan wanted to cut his losses. So you make it look like not retreat, but like redeployment.
Did the blue smoke gambit work for Reagan?
It generally worked for Reagan because he was such a convincing communicator. But it generally catches up to whoever tries to use it if they use it too much. Let me give you an example. You know, in the Vietnam days, when I was a young man working in the Pentagon, it was common to call the bombing of the North, not the bombing of the North, but the dropping of ordnance. And finally, in 68, when we got to the table with the North Vietnamese, we didn't call it negotiations because there was so much opposition in this country to negotiating with the devil that we called it talks, and talks went down more easily.
And what about more recently?
Well, most recently, we've had the most creative example of blue smoke imaginable. The people who want us to really hang in there in Iraq, stay the course, really are saying, we need to buy time, another year or two, to see whether this commitment can work. But they know they can't say that. People would be outraged. So Tom Friedman and the White House invented the new line, which was, the next 3 to 6 months will be crucial.
And they've been talking about the critical 6 months in some form or another since, what, 2004?
Right. And General Abizaid modified it the other day in his testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee by saying the next 3 to 4 months will be crucial.
Well, Les, let's hope we speak again after a crucial, say, 3 to 6 months.
I'll be listening to your ordinance.
Thanks very much.
Take care.
Les Gelb is President Emeritus of the Council on Foreign Relations. On the other side of the political fence is Frederick Kagan, a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute who favors sending more troops to Iraq. He agrees that there's a lot of wordplay going on, but he says even if the terms withdrawal and redeployment were used properly, it really wouldn't matter.
There's certainly a difference, I think, in the intentions of the people who are using the different terms differently. But I think when you actually consider what military reality on the ground will be, there isn't any realistic difference between the two.
So it's not exactly that the Democrats are using redeployment as a euphemism for withdrawal. They're really talking about redeploying troops to the periphery of the country. But you're saying that the security implications of a phased redeployment would be pretty much the same as if we brought them all home.
Yes, that's exactly what I'm saying. I do not believe in the end that if we have redeployed our forces to forward operating bases in Kuwait or, heaven help us, Guam, that we will actually end up using them in Iraq. Keep in mind that it's about 600 miles from Kuwait to Baghdad, and the problems that we're dealing with are going to be either in Baghdad or to the north of there.
I'm just wondering, hasn't there been a discussion of maintaining some of the forward operating bases within Iraq minimally so that they could serve as staging areas?
If you're going to have forward operating bases in Iraq, then you have to have secure lines of communication that run from Kuwait to those bases, which means that you have to have troops patrolling the roads that lead from Kuwait in all the way 600 miles to Baghdad and then to the north of that. It also implies that you're going to have a large presence in Baghdad. You're going to require several brigades to secure the green zone in Baghdad, where we're still going to have a very large embassy staff. And you're going to require a lot of brigades to protect the forward operating bases. In other words, you're still going to have tens and tens of thousands of American troops running around the country. The only real difference is that they will be entirely defensive. They will still be taking attacks. They will still be taking hits. But they will be doing nothing at all positive to contribute directly to security. Therefore, it really doesn't matter whether they're stationed in Kuwait or Guam or Pakistan or South America, for that matter. The issue is, are we going to continue to be involved in helping the Iraqis establish a peaceful, stable state, or are we not? And from that perspective, I think there's not going to be a meaningful difference.
So do you want to weigh in on the rhetorical issues here? Are we talking about choosing terms on the basis of sales, selling a policy? Does withdrawal simply have too many overtones of surrender?
Yeah, I think that, you know, there are a lot of people who are trying to convince themselves and others that there is some middle ground and that we can reduce the level of pain that we're suffering without accepting defeat. And my problem is that that really is just rhetorical. In terms of stark military reality, there are two choices. We can either stay with a large presence actively engaged in fighting the insurgency and attempting to achieve security, or the situation will collapse. And I think efforts to have rhetorical devices that obscure that are actually harmful to the debate.
Well, do you think the media have been doing as much as they ought to sort all of this out?
I think it would be very helpful if the media would continually press advocates, both of withdrawal phased or not and of redeployment phased or not, to define in very sharp military terms what exactly they think that would look like. I think we've had a failure of imagination all along as people have been making sentences about how we can pull out and we can withdraw and the Iraqis will fight and so forth. But I think that the media really needs to challenge proponents of various plans on both sides and say, tell me what this is actually going to look like day to day on the ground in Iraq as this happens. And until we've actually had a discussion with that level of concreteness, then I think we can't make a sound decision about what's the right thing to do.
All right, Fred, thank you very much.
Pleasure to talk to you.
Military historian Fred Kagan is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. And now, courtesy of the Huffington Post, a leaked internal memo from Fox News chief John Moody last Thursday to his staff. Like previous such memos, it laid out the day's news agenda in a way curiously advantageous to the GOP.
Here's the key marching order connecting the Democrats to terrorism. Quote, "Let's be on the lookout for any statement from the Iraqi insurgents who must be thrilled at the prospect of a Dem-controlled Congress." Here's Fox News Channel's Martha McCollum on the Live Desk program later that morning.
Yeah, there have been some reports of cheering in the streets on the behalf of supporters of the insurgency in Iraq, that they're very pleased with the way things are going here and also with the resignation of Donald Rumsfeld.
What a coincidence. Just curious, though, hearing reports from who? What's the source? Maybe it arrived in another morning memo. We report. You decide.
So last week, Bob was in Istanbul, and next week, he'll tell us what he found there. Tune in Thanksgiving weekend for Bob's musings on Turkey's media landscape.
This is a ferry boat crossing the Bosphorus from Asia to Europe. See what I mean? It's a metaphor.
Turns out some cliches are actually true. Coming up right after the break, a conversation with Lou Dobbs, America's conscience or crank? And another internet indecency bill has its day in court. This is On the Media from NPR.
That's nobody's business but the Turks. Istanbul.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A few years ago, Lou Dobbs was the host of CNN's Moneyline and, as such, one of the world's most prominent financial journalists. But in the past 3 years, with his program renamed Lou Dobbs Tonight, his prominence has dramatically increased. Also, his audience, his airtime, now 6 days a week, and his stridency.
And will Congress give amnesty to millions of illegal aliens who've crossed
our
borders?
And a proposed federal plan to hold employers of illegal aliens accountable.
Is this government finally beginning to understand
food insecurity?
There's low food
security. These are just abject idiots. I don't even want to.
The deputy mayor of a small Texas town, among a growing number of cities and towns across the nation, taking action on their own to confront our illegal immigration crisis while the federal government does nothing.
Dobbs has turned his evening hour into a daily diatribe on the perils of free trade, the travails of the middle class, and especially the threat of illegal immigration. He calls the influx of illegals an invasion, the kind of rhetoric that prompted a response from Andrea Batista Schlesinger, executive director of the Drum Major Institute, a think tank dedicated to strengthening America's middle class. In an open letter, she asked Dobbs to consider the ways in which legal and illegal immigration strengthen our communities.
So when I got on the show, he introduced me right from the start as a leading critic of his border control policy. And essentially, the show went downhill from there. The first question, and I don't know if this is typical of journalists, but the first question was something to the effect of what's wrong with, or doesn't it make sense that? And that was basically, you know, the tenor of the interview, that he has the monopoly on what makes sense. I mean, he was not interested in actually hearing what I had to say. He was interested in explaining what he had to say as if it were the most common sense thing that everybody would agree upon. I thought I was going on that show to have a serious conversation that, weighed the pros and the cons of immigration policies that are on the table. Instead, I was a foil for a lecture on the difference between a Hispanic and an immigrant, which as a Hispanic and the daughter of an immigrant, I found very enlightening. It wasn't a conversation. I had about 30 seconds to make my case.
Did you say to him, are you out of your mind? How dare you?
Well, I was stunned and I was a little embarrassed, but I said that was 30 seconds. I thought we were going to talk. The most interesting piece of the interview experience was what happened on my BlackBerry in the 5 minutes following my appearance. I mean, it was rattling uncontrollably with emails, probably 30, 50 within the next hour, you know, with vitriol, people taking on everything from my position legitimately to my choice of shirt. It was incredible. In that short a time period, people had to literally watch the show, go onto their computers, find my organization, find my email address, and then compose emails. They were motivated by the kind of ire that Lou whips up. And that's my real critique of him, is that he leaves people with nothing constructive.
You know, what can we learn from this episode?
Well, obviously, I have new ideas about what to wear when I go on Lou Dobbs. So there was a lesson learned from me. The reason that I'm obsessed with Lou instead of hating him is because there are very few media outlets that will talk about all of these things in the way that people actually experience them. So, you know, people watching Lou's show don't think, you know, today is healthcare day for me. Today is an education policy day for me. Today is, you know, tax cuts for me. They think about their overall condition because their difficulty paying their gas bills is related to their tax policy and their property taxes for their home, which is related to the money that they're spending sending their kids to college, which is related to the fact that they're not secure any longer about their retirement. So they experience things as an overall feeling of anxiety. And Lou speaks directly to that anxiety.
Well, but isn't there a word for that? On the one hand, you could say it's sensitive, but isn't it also demagoguery?
His behavior is demagoguery. His approach to linking all of these issues together to speak truth to a condition that people are feeling in a way that will resonate with them is important. I don't think that's demagoguery. I think that's smart. We have to look at how all of these issues connect, and he does.
Andrea, thank you.
Thank you so much.
Andrea Batista Schlesinger is executive director of the Drum Major Institute. Schlesinger took pains to credit Lou Dobbs for his determination to highlight the struggles of the middle class against corporate venality and a corrupt political establishment. Dobbs' new book, War on the Middle Class, How the Government, Big Business, and Special Interest Groups Are Waging War on the American Dream and How to Fight Back, in many ways corresponds with subjects and viewpoints expressed on this very program. But like Schlesinger and like many other media organizations, from Slate to the Associated Press to the Financial Times to The Nation, we have a lot of questions about Dobbs' techniques. His journalistic philosophy, he told us, begins with not hiding behind the artifice of supposed balance.
I'm, first of all, an advocacy journalist, and I make no pretense whatsoever of so-called objectivity. The journalism I practice is based on our best efforts to obtain an independent, nonpartisan reality that is shaping the lives of all Americans, and that's our commitment.
I'm going to ask you about your relationship with CNN itself. Mm-hmm. Now, network president Jonathan Klein has said to the New York Times that, in essence, that the Dobbs approach will only be on the Dobbs show. And presumably he means that it would never fly on Wolf Blitzer's show or Paula Zahn's show.
Well, they're quite different people than I am, as you know.
I understand. But why should you have a different set of journalistic standards applying to you?
Well, immodestly, let me say, one of the reasons would be my experience, my education, my analysis of the issues and the empirical evidence, and a demonstrated record of, frankly, of knowing what I'm talking about.
You do polls on your show.
All the time.
But they aren't really polls.
Of course they are. They really are.
They're leading questions, Lou. They're more like the push polls that you hear in hear about in political campaigns. Is this research?
It is. It's a fair reading, I believe, of what our audience is thinking, yes.
Here's a poll question from Tuesday's broadcast. It was about the Vatican declaring that the border wall is inhuman.
Absolutely.
Do you believe, as the Vatican asserts in a statement from within its walled city, that building a fence on the U.S. border with Mexico is inhuman? Now, oddly enough, Lou, that got a 90% no vote. That must have
was it only 90? It was only 90? I'm disappointed because I thought it would be much higher.
Yeah, I kind of have you cold here. Here's another. Which do you believe Senator Hillary Clinton is most out of touch with? And then you list various things that you suppose she's out of touch with: illegal immigration, border security, and so on.
How did she do? I'm just curious. I can't remember the outcome of that one.
She seems to be out of touch with everything, according to the results. It's hot button pressing, is it not?
No, I don't think it's hot button pressing. It is, first of all, some measure of validation for what people are thinking.
You concede that you do advocacy, and you proudly...
No, I don't concede it. I don't concede it at all. I proudly declare it.
Okay, and you also proudly declare that that you're a populist. You did a piece about that this very day. We're speaking on Wednesday. I'm going to give you a list of names here. Huey Long, Father Coughlin, Bill O'Reilly, Walter Winchell, Louis Farrakhan. There's a thin line between populism and demagoguery, where you actually inflame the public into a sort of a mob. What makes you think you haven't crossed that line?
What makes you think I have? I think is the way we would begin this journalistically. The burden of proof would be on you, would it not? Let me say to you, first of all, one distinction that would be made rather quickly between myself and all of those luminaries that you mentioned would be that I'm an independent populist. I have no partisan view, no political agenda of any kind. And that is straightforward and absolutely demonstrated to my audience, which is very sophisticated and discerning and demanding each evening.
Let's talk for a moment about illegal immigration, which I believe you've discussed once or twice or 30 trillion times on your program.
Relentlessly is what my critics like to use. I like to say I reported on the issue thoroughly and in an ongoing fashion.
But let's just say that your conclusions about illegal immigration are based on a cool analysis of the facts.
Right.
But do you not see how the constant hammering of that kind of rhetoric fans flames of less cool-headed analysis of jingoism and racism and hysteria? Don't you have some responsibility for how your message is being translated?
Oh, I think I have a great responsibility for how my skills at communication and how my use of language is perceived and received by my audience. I have no responsibility for those who would try to ignore my actual statements and twist those words in order to create a polemical argument.
But when you talk about an invasion, why shouldn't I see this as just a 21st century version of, you know, fear of the Irish or of yellow peril or any of the other such scourges that were supposed to destroy our society?
The truth is that I have never made a racist statement in my life, period. I have never made a jingoistic statement, a nativist statement. And by the way, think about something. You used historical figures, no matter how nefarious in some instances. Think about what nativism means in the 21st century, Bob. We are the most racially and ethnically diverse society on the face of the earth. And by the way, I'm not an immigration restrictionist. It may stun you to learn if you're reading clippings from some of those who torture and twist things to their own advantage politically. The fact is, I've called for an increase in immigration to this country. But I believe that that increase in immigration should be determined by the United States government, not by the government of Mexico.
Your monomania on the subject of the war against the middle class and on borders and so forth, you strike me as the Captain Ahab of cable news. Can you live with that description?
Yeah, I can live with it as long as it's your description. I would be a little more concerned if it was my wife, my family's, my friends, and my audience's view, which I can tell you it is not. Does it concern you also that I was monomaniacal about the Dubai Ports World sale, that I'm monomaniacal on e-voting machines and the threat they pose to our democracy? Does it concern you that our health care is rising in double-digit rates without any response on the part of public policy for the middle class in this country? Does it concern you that both parties are funded almost entirely by corporate America? The middle class may be a monomaniacal interest of mine, but it's heartfelt and carries with it a host of issues that are beyond the range of most, if I may say, most broadcast journalists.
All right, Lou. Well, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Bob.
Lou Dobbs hosts Lou Dobbs Tonight on CNN. He's the author of War on the Middle Class, How the Government, Big Business, and Special Interest Groups Are Waging War on the American Dream, and How to Fight Back.
Closing arguments are set for this Monday in ACLU versus Gonzalez, the latest chapter in the long embattled history of the Child Online Protection Act, or COPPA, passed in 1998. Under the law, child unfriendly content would be placed behind a virtual wall, and users would have to supply a credit card number or otherwise verify their age in order to view it. Websites like Salon, an edgy online news magazine, and Nerve, which serves up a kind of highbrow erotica, argue that such a wall would deter readers and effectively shut them down. Only COPPA has never been enforced. For the past 8 years, the law has bounced around the judicial system, struck down on constitutional grounds by the higher courts, and remanded back to the district level, where it now lies in what may be its death throes, if the American Civil Liberties Union gets its way. Carrie Howley, an associate editor at Reason Magazine, has followed the case and joins us now. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So laws like COPPA often are a product of their times, right? In this case, it was the late 90s when the internet was relatively young and the climate was nervous.
Exactly. Looking back over the transcripts of the trial, the thing that jumps out most to me is just how dated this law was, how it's really a product of another time. It's a throwback. It was a time when the internet was a relatively scary thing. It was something that children often knew more about than their parents. And there's an iconic cover of Time magazine that really captures this. In 1995, they released a cover featuring a maybe three-year-old boy staring into a computer screen wide-eyed, and his face was sort of bathed in a blue glow from the screen. And the cover said cyber porn in these great block letters.
Reason magazine is a libertarian magazine and would certainly take the position almost every time that the government should stay out of this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But if you're a parent, it is pretty awful out there.
It is. It is.
And you shouldn't worry about that.
I'm not sure that you shouldn't worry. I am sure that the best approach is communication, not this impossible Herculean task of keeping your children from information, passing silly laws.
So when a law is challenged in court, there's often a kind of Talmudic dissection, sometimes word by word, of the language of the law. What does COPPA really say?
Well, COPPA says that commercial distributors of material harmful to minors need to put that material behind some kind of wall.
So let's break that down word by word. What does the law mean by harmful?
That's a good question. I don't think anyone really knows what that means. According to the law, the average person applying contemporary community standards would find taking the material as a whole and with respect to minors is designed to appeal to or is designed to pander to the purient interest.
Or, quote, lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value for minors. I don't even want to ask what they mean by serious.
That's incredibly vague and subjective, just as the concept of pornography itself is quite subjective.
So let's begin with how the government is arguing its case. You've noted that the lead attorney with the Justice Department, Eric Bean, employed a novel strategy in his opening statement. Could you read what he said in court?
Sure. He warned the judge, remember this isn't a jury trial, it's only a judge. He said, it's important not to let this trial become a purely intellectual exercise. It's important not to become emotionally detached.
Well, what is he actually saying there? He's exhorting the judge to stay emotional about it?
To stay emotionally involved with the issue of pornography and as it relates to children, which generally people do have quite visceral, strong reactions to. I think he's understandably afraid that this trial will be about facts, about statutes.
About amendments, maybe?
About amendments. And it's very hard to maintain this sort of hysteria in that kind of atmosphere. And in his opening statement, Bean planned to use 6 hardcore images plucked from the vast array of internet smut.
So let's move to the ACLU's attorney, Chris Hansen.
Hansen, in his opening statement, which was before Bean's, pointed out that 4 of the 6 images that Bean would be presenting were actually from overseas. Now, the law is designed to shield kids from pornography, but of course it can't do that because the United States legislature can only shut down sites within the United States. So 50% of the pornography that's out there that's generated overseas, it will have no effect on.
Oh.
Which really speaks to how ineffectual the law is, even for its intended purpose, whether it's constitutional or not.
Now, what the ACLU has said, in fact, critics of these kinds of laws since they were first presented have always said, is that this is a family responsibility, a parental responsibility, and there are good filters that you can use to protect kids from this really smutty stuff on the web. The government counters that parents won't use those filters.
The government has really been hitting on the idea that we can't rely on these because not only are they ineffective, but parents are unlikely to know how to use them. One of the arguments was that kids understand how to keep them from working. Parents don't understand how to install them. I actually think that there's some merit to that argument. Private filters are clumsy, but they're not nearly as clumsy as COPPA.
Carrie, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Carrie Howley is associate editor of Reason Magazine.
Coming up, Al Jazeera launches a new channel in English, but U.S. distributors don't want to hear it.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Some of the nation's best newspapers are family affairs. The Grahams own the Washington Post, the Bancrofts, the Wall Street Journal, and the Sulzbergers, the New York Times. But while the Grahams have diversified wisely and done well by the Post, sagging stock prices have sparked family strife at the Journal, and now even the Sulzbergers are feeling the pinch. All these papers share one noteworthy feature: two classes of stock, one for public investors to keep investment dollars flowing, and one that packs extra voting power for the families. Morgan Stanley money manager Hassan El-Masri wants to take that system down. His company owns more than 7% of New York Times stock. Last week, he submitted resolutions to be voted on at next year's annual meeting of stockholders that would give non-Sulzbergers more clout. Without family support, it can't win. But it does show, says New Yorker staff writer Ken Auletta, that investors want more bang for their buck.
They feel that if they own the same share, that they should have the same vote as a Sulzberger family member who owns the same share.
And gets double votes.
So from their vantage point, they think it's undemocratic. From the Sulzberger's vantage point, they feel that the only way to protect journalism from the predatory practices or the short-term thinking of investors is to have two classes of stock so that they could continue to invest in improving the newspaper.
The pressure is for Arthur Sulzberger Jr. to give up his dual positions of publisher and chairman. Do you think his management has helped or hurt the paper?
Look, if you look at performance, you'd have to say the New York Times has not performed as well as it should have as a business over the last 10 years. That's clear. And if you're the chairman of that company and publisher of the newspaper, you bear some measure of blame for that. So Arthur Sulzberger Jr. is being roughed up by a lot of people, and sometimes deservedly so. But what is often overlooked and shouldn't be, in fairness, is that the New York Times is arguably the greatest newspaper in the world, and a paper that saved itself over the last more than a decade by going national. The person who made that decision was Arthur Sulzberger Jr.
He's also taken a few hits, hasn't he, for editorial management. He didn't seem to handle the Howell Raines, Jason Blair mess too well. And, of course, the Judy Miller situation kind of blew up in his face as well.
In both cases, he came off to cold-eyed investors as someone who could be a little supercilious at times and not mature. And that hurt him. On the other hand, you see, if you look at it from a journalist's point of view, you look at Arthur Sulzberger and you say, my God, this guy believes in quality. They have 1,200 people doing news all around the world. He puts more beef in the stew even when the stew is thinning because he believes that good journalism wins out in the end, and that's important.
Is there any sense that the family is beginning to divide on Arthur Sulzberger?
I don't sense that at all. My sense is that family feels that if you attack Arthur Sulzberger Jr., you are attacking them. They have no illusions that the Morgan Stanley person who is making this claim and this effort to change the two classes of stock, he's not just going after Arthur Sulzberger Jr., he's going after the whole notion of family ownership and the thing that is their religion. They grew up in the Sulzberger family, and they try and instill that value system. We are the best newspaper in the world. We put more money into journalism. We don't preoccupy ourselves with profits and greed.
I guess the grisliest cautionary tale about the opposing interests of business and family ownership is the LA Times, recently with the firing of the esteemed, though short-lived, editor Dean Bakke. Now, when the Chandler family owned the LA Times, they had the two-tiered stock system, and that went away when the Tribune Company bought the LA Times. It also seems to have ushered in an era of constant trauma at that paper. Can you sort of sum that up?
When the Chandler family sold, because of dissension within the family in part, they were sold to a company that had a different value system and was not just in the newspaper business, but was heavily into television and newspapers not of the quality of any of them, really, of the LA Times or the Chicago Tribune is a good newspaper, but not a great newspaper. And that cultural divide is a very hard one to overcome. And that's what we're witnessing with the, in part, with the attacks on the New York Times today. But we're witnessing something else, and I think it's real important to say this on behalf of the Tribune Company or Wall Street or anyone who says, my God, what's your plan for growth in the future? And that's a fair question to be asking. And it's one that journalists should climb out of our bunkers and not just look, how do we do good journalism, but how do we attract readers?
There seems to be some kind of strange middle way emerging among papers that are being bought or at least courted by single wealthy individuals or consortiums of wealthy individuals. John Tierney, a prominent Philadelphia businessman, recently bought the Philadelphia Inquirer. Wealthy buyers are eyeing the Chicago Tribune, the Boston Globe, and even the LA Times. Do they know something that we don't?
Well, one of the things they know, and this is a really important thing, in the age of conglomerates, where small newspapers and radio and television stations are taken over by giant corporations and they lose their local ties, local business people who have made a lot of money say, my God, I want to have local ownership. I want to have people who care about this community. And some of these wealthy people are saying, look, I'm prepared to take a smaller profit margin. I want a profit because I'm a businessman. I'm willing to take a lesser profit and I'm going to take the company private and therefore I'm not going to worry about fickle Wall Street. That's a potentially a very exciting thing in that it's people who are saying, we feel the same sense of public trust that the Sulzberger family feels. On the other hand, the crunch question becomes, what happens if Jack Welch owns the Boston Globe? Or David Geffen or Eli Broad own the LA Times. What happens the first time their new newspaper does a piece on one of their friends they don't like? Will they defend it? And that's a question that the jury's out on. The jury is not out on how the Sulzbergers respond to that. They've proven over the years that the journalism comes first.
Ken, thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Ken Auletta is a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine.
After more than three tumultuous years of preparation, and despite an 11th-hour disappointment, Wednesday marked the launch of Al Jazeera English.
Welcome to the world news from Al Jazeera, and the very first program live from our Doha news headquarters here in the heart of the Middle East.
In the next hour, we'll be going live to the world's top news stories.
I'm Nurode in the Gaza Strip, which has been brought to the brink of chaos and despair by sanctions, siege, and shelling.
I'm Haru Mitasa in Darfur, scene of the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
I'm Raghi Omar in Tehran. Could Iran's president really hold the key to peace in the Middle East?
On Al Jazeera, we'll be setting the news agenda. In this hour, we'll also be...
The sister service of the Pan-Arab Satellite TV channel will be, according to its mission statement, setting the news agenda for a projected 70 million households worldwide. It will not, however, reach the U.S. subscribers of Comcast. That cable giant this week pulled out of a deal that would have given Al Jazeera English access to its 12.1 million digital cable subscribers, leaving the fledgling channel without any major U.S. distribution. It can be seen here only via online streaming and by subscribers of the Globecast satellite service. A year ago, we spoke to Arab media scholar Marwan Crady. He predicted difficulties for Nigel Parsons, the managing editor of the network, then called Al Jazeera International, in getting U.S. distribution. He also predicted that the English language version would be quite different from its Arab sibling, which often airs inflammatory anti-Western rhetoric and videos seemingly calculated to provoke extremist reaction.
One of the things with Al Jazeera is that their editorial policy is still a work in progress, even Al Jazeera Arabic. They're debating it, they're working on it. At the same time, it will really depend on how long these relatively famous journalists will stick with the network. In other words, if the working conditions are good, if they feel they really have editorial freedom to say what they want, I think there's a chance that they'll stay. And if they do stay, that will obviously attract other people with well-established names and careers.
Al Jazeera Arabic has been, if not necessarily an advocate of Islamism and jihadism, or even necessarily being sympathetic to those causes, it's certainly been hospitable to rhetoric about them and has had all sorts of accompanying very inflammatory images. Do you think we'll be seeing similar kind of incendiary images played over and over and over on Al Jazeera International? And do you think we'll be seeing the same kind of rhetoric from extremists who have had access to Al Jazeera Arabic's signal?
I don't believe so, for a very simple reason. Consider the audience. And Nigel Parsons has already met several people in the U.S., in the administration, some business leaders. I think they're on a charm offensive to say, look, we're not Al Jazeera Arabic. We're going to be very fair. We're going to be balanced. Give us a chance. The other thing to think about is who are going to be the people invited as guests on talk shows. The people who would be able to speak English fluent enough to be on the air will tend to be different from those who can speak fluent Arabic. And I'm not saying they will be less radical. On the contrary, some of them will probably be more radical. But I think because the audience will be much broader, my guess is that the range of discourse will be also broader.
Am I making a basic mistake by assuming that because it's an English language channel, that it necessarily is targeting Western countries like the United States?
I think in terms of sheer number of viewers, I definitely think that Asia is going to be the main place where they will find viewers, perhaps in the millions. You know, English now is probably the lingua franca of Islam. It's definitely competing with Arabic. If you look at the large Muslim populations of Southeast Asia and South Asia, you know, Indonesia is the most populous Muslim country. And a lot of these people speak English, Malaysia, Pakistan, India. And so we have a huge audience right there that is politicized, that is looking for what perhaps it thinks of as an Islamic point of view, and that will definitely turn to Al Jazeera International. It's very likely that they will have a very large audience in addition in the West. Not just Arabs and sons of Arabs and Muslims who only know English because they grew up in the U.S. or Canada or Australia, but also people in the West who are looking for alternative news.
Well, Marwan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Marwan Crady is a faculty member at the American University School of International Service in Washington. Also in Washington, where he will anchor the Al Jazeera English U.S. Bureau, is Dave Marish. The former Nightline correspondent signed on to this new project in February, joining such prominent names as Sir David Frost and former U.S. Marine Press officer Joshua Rushing, featured in the documentary Control Room. In February, Dave Marish told us he was joining a revolution in progress.
Al Jazeera in Arabic is, I believe, one of the most revolutionary and positive influences on the Arabic-speaking, mostly Islamic Middle Eastern world in literally centuries. It has opened up public discourse, and it has brought American standards of reporting to an area that previously had nothing but really moronically state-controlled television and news operations.
Al Jazeera in Arabic serves some 40 million Arabic-speaking viewers around the world, but mostly in the Middle East. According to Marish, Al Jazeera aims to create the widest possible debate, and that means including the most extreme views.
And to us in the West, the extremes of that context seem obnoxious or worse, even intolerable. But in that region, if Al Jazeera in Arabic were politically correct and scrubbed the extremes from its debate, it would lose all of its credibility with its viewers, who know that anti-Israeli attitudes are prevalent in the region, and flat, ugly anti-Semitic attitudes are also widely distributed. The only way that I believe that they can be combated is in direct intellectual combat, and you can't do that by excluding them. Now, Al Jazeera International is going to be a global channel operating from four regional bases, 11 hours a day from Doha in Qatar, 5 hours a day from London, 5 hours a day from Washington, 3 hours a day from Kuala Lumpur. Over the course of a 24-hour day, you're going to hear globally significant news stories discussed and approached from four different regional points of view.
Al Jazeera is principally owned by the Emirate of Qatar, and your salary, I presume, ultimately comes from government coffers. How does that affect the way you're going to approach your work, and Do you fear some sort of political restraints on what Al Jazeera International may be able to do?
In a way, that's one of Al Jazeera's advantages, I believe, Bob. The state of Qatar has about 150,000 people in it. It has some oil, but not huge oil wealth. And the state and the emir have basically made a capitalist decision that there are two sectors in which they are going to take their present oil revenue and try and make that a base for future revenue. One of those sectors is the media, the various Al Jazeera channels. The other is education, where the wife of the emir has been instrumental in setting up a large university in Qatar, expected to become, as Al Jazeera is expected to become, a revenue-producing a capitalist base, if you will, for this state. Qatar really has one national interest other than its economic growth, and that would be survival. Beyond that, it can hardly pretend to have real national interests, and so therefore, Al Jazeera is almost perfectly clear of any national interest or any dictated political policy.
I want to ask you one final thing. You're Jewish, and you've already taken some criticism of being a self-loathing Jew, anti-Semitic, anti-Israel. You've been called Marish of Arabia. What's it like going through this experience and dealing with that portion of the American Jewish community that thinks you're a traitor?
You have to just shake off what are basically hysterical, ignorant, and ugly statements. I am proud to be a Jew. I believe if harmony is to be achieved between the Judeo-Christian West and the mostly Islamic Middle East, the first people who will be making steps towards peace on the Arab side are the modernizers, are the secularists, are the free market, free speakers. In other words, the very people who started and back and, I believe, listen to value Al Jazeera in Arabic and hopefully Al Jazeera International. I'm proud to associate myself with those on the Jewish side who do seek peace and harmony. And if that offends some of my co-religionists or fellow Americans, all I can say is it's a free country.
All right, Dave. Well, good luck in the new gig.
Thank you, Bob.
Dave Marish is the Washington anchor for Al Jazeera English. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Volo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson, our engineer. We had engineering help from Rob Christensen and other help from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org, which has been redesigned for your viewing pleasure. And you can email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bidell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.